minds to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and the Honorable Court.
Good morning, everyone. All right. The first case this morning is 022754, Zurich American versus the Superior Court of California. Mr. McKeith, you're going to take 5 minutes.
5 minutes to open, Your Honor. Thank you. My name is David McCush. I represent appellant and cross-appellee Watts Industry. Your Honor, in the limited time I have here this morning, I wish to emphasize just a couple of points of concern. First, we want to talk briefly about why the preliminary injunction here was not allowed under the Anti-Injunction Act. Second, while Watts has no disagreement with the lower court's Rooker-Feldman analysis, we are concerned that the district court misinterpreted the California court's non-arbitrability order and did not give that clarification issued by that court appropriate deference. In the end, Your Honor, what we ask the court to do, to issue, is a very clear, forthright statement that the California Superior Court can proceed with the insurance policy issues that have been long pending before it now for more than 19 months. With respect to the Anti-Injunction Act, let me just put before the court a few factual benchmarks, time benchmarks. The petition to compel arbitration here was filed fully 8 months after the coverage action was first filed. The injunction that Zurich sought was sought fully 6 months after the California court issued its non-arbitrability ruling and began to rule on the merits of the policy questions before it. That injunction itself was issued 3 months before a motion to compel arbitration was filed, and more than 4 months before the lower court finally issued a decision on the merits just this past month. Now, under the Anti-Injunction Act, we are aware of no case that allows an injunction before a federal court rules on the question of arbitrability. We cited some cases to that effect. There's no case that enjoins a state court from proceeding on the merits that have not yet been reached by the federal court. And there is much less is there any case that in which a federal court enjoins a state court after the state court has first ruled on the question of arbitrability. And we respectfully suggest that the injunction here was inappropriate even if the district court misapprehended the scope of the non-arbitrability ruling. And why is that? That's because it violates basic principles of federalism as embodied in the Anti-Injunction Act. The U.S. Supreme Court itself, in the Vendo decisions and elsewhere, has indicated that there is no prohibition against parallel state and federal proceedings in in personam actions such as were involved here. And as the Vendo court also indicated, there is no case that has ever held that an injunction is appropriate to preserve a case or controversy under the necessary and aid of jurisdiction exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. And the cases, in other words, what the court did here is issue an injunction in anticipation of a decision that the district court might make in the future, a hypothetical decision which it might make, ultimately it never did make, in our opinion, this last month. And that is not an appropriate exercise of any exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. A word about the cases that Zurich has cited to support its position under the Anti-Injunction Act. That's BMS, Winkler, and Sun America, among some others. All of those cases were instances in which the federal court had first issued a ruling and then later issued an injunction against a subsequent state action, and those injunctions were justified under the Protect and Effectuate exception of the Anti-Injunction Act, a ground not invoked here. Here, moreover, it was exactly the opposite situation obtained. That is because it was the state court that first ruled on the merits of the arbitrability, at least as it pertained to the insurance policy question, not as it pertains to deductible agreement issues, but the state court acted first. So in our case, as these other cases hold, rests on the policies against forum shopping, exactly what Zurich did here.
Can I ask you a question about the impact of Judge Bucklow's final order, September 9th order? Doesn't that moot both parties' appeal in the preliminary injunction?
It's my view that it does, Your Honor. As Zurich has pointed out, Zurich has, since that ruling, has filed a Rule 59e
right.
motion. So I think technically that ruling is not final. I think Judge Bucklow is going to rule on that motion, I understand, next week. But if, after considering the reconsideration motion, there's no change, it is my view that it moots the preliminary injunction, because the preliminary injunction applied against to further proceedings on policy-related issues, and her final ruling does not appear to refer any insurance policy issues to arbitration. So it is our view that decision would moot result in a dissolution of the preliminary injunction and thereby moot the appeal. But she still has before her a reconsideration motion, so I can't technically tell you it does that today. You see, my light is... all right, I'll reserve my remaining time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stansler, good morning.
Jordan Stanles are representing James Jones Company. I'd just like to briefly point out Judge Bucklow's ruling of September 9th does more thoroughly address the issues as to James Jones Company, namely that James Jones Company never signed these deductible agreements. There was no intent that James Jones be bound by them, and hence there's no reason to enjoin James Jones for anything. We never agreed to arbitrate, and we're not bound by these arbitration provisions. The single most important fact there, I believe, is that two out of three of the signed agreements that have an arbitration provision were signed in 1999. Well, in 1999, James Jones had been sold for 3 years. James Jones was sold in 1996. The point there being, these parties never intended to include James Jones in any arbitration provision. The deductible agreements we're talking about simply provide that if Zurich makes a payment on behalf of Watts, Watts owes them some money. And that's all that these agreements are. James Jones at one time was a subsidiary of Watts, but this agreement had nothing to do with James Jones Company. And in fact, the parties were willing to sign these agreements years after the insurance policies were issued and years after James Jones Company had been sold. So there's no intent ever to bind James Jones in these deductible agreements that have an arbitration provision. In the ruling on preliminary injunction, incidentally, Judge Bucklow addressed a different issue, whether Zurich had shown any likelihood of success as to whether Jones had signed or not agreed to a particular letter. That issue seems to have disappeared now in all the briefing, and we seem to all have gone to the merits. Is there any basis to include a non-signatory, to force a non-signatory to arbitrate when that party never agreed to arbitrate? Zurich has come up with one or two theories that just don't fit under the facts. One being, well, you were a subsidiary. That doesn't work. You just can't force someone to arbitrate merely because they were a subsidiary. The second argument they have floated is that there was some benefit to James Jones Company under these agreements. We recognize there was a benefit under the insurance policies, but there was no particular benefit under these deductible agreements that have the arbitration provision. There was just nothing in it for James Jones Company. The obligations were simply between Zurich and Watts about payment of money. The last argument that seems to have been floated, and this is in the Rule 59E motion, that there's an agency agreement, and there are no facts in the record on that. That argument would go that James Jones told Watts, you go get these deductible agreements for us. There are no facts in the record to suggest that. There's been no testimony to that effect. There's nothing in the record about James Jones doing anything to procure these deductible agreements. On all these facts, Your Honor, Your Honors, I would suggest there's no reason to bound James Jones to these agreements. Fundamentally, you can't force someone to arbitrate an agreement that a party has never agreed to arbitrate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McBride, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. Andrew McBride on behalf of Zurich American. Let me start with Judge Williams' question, which I think was an important one. Zurich American believes this case is not moot because during the period that a partial injunction was issued, Zurich was forced to pay $9.5 million in defense costs pursuant to an order that we think never should have been entered by the California court. I think that the key issue in this case is the Rooker-Feldman issue and whether or not the district court lost jurisdiction over a petition to arbitrate that was filed prior to any ruling by the state court or any issue of arbitrability placed before the state court.
You know what's interesting about your argument and Rooker-Feldman? Your argument seems to me to be that Watts' interpretation of Rooker-Feldman leads to a race to judgment between, you know, the state and federal courts, but so does yours. And it creates a similar race, but at a different time. Under your scenario, a party has to race to file a claim in federal court before the state court has ruled.
Well, Your Honor, I might point out, I think that is not the case here. Zurich went to federal court after it received a letter on September 6, 2001 from Watts that linked the issue of coverage to the issue of the deductible agreements. And what Watts said is, you've breached your duty to defend us under the insurance agreement, therefore you have no right to these deductibles. At that point, a dispute was created under the broad arbitration clause of the deductible agreement, and that dispute should have gone to arbitration. So there was no forum shopping by Zurich in that sense. Watts said, hey, these deductible agreements do not apply because of your conduct under the insurance contract, and that then became a dispute about the applicability of the deductible agreement. I would point out, Your Honor, if I could, on the other side of the coin, I think because this is a jurisdictional doctrine, Rooker-Feldman, the judgment has to be made the day the complaint is filed. If that's not true, the complaint in federal court was filed on October 4, 2001. On that date, there was no ruling of any kind from the state court. It's hard to see under this court's precedence, Gash and Centers, Inc., how Zurich's complaint could be a functional appeal of anything because there was no state ruling to appeal. The guts of Rooker-Feldman from the Supreme Court is this is a defense of the appellate jurisdiction of the state courts all the way through to certiorari under 28 U.S.C. 1257. But at the time Zurich filed its petition to arbitrate in federal court, there was nothing to appeal. There was no state court ruling at all. And in fact, and this is an important point, the state court did not rule on arbitrability. It denied a stay pending the district court in Illinois' determination as to arbitrability. And in fact, Watts told the appellate court in California, this is not a merits ruling. It is, in fact, only a procedural ruling on a stay, which is non-appealable in California.
Let me just take you somewhere else for a moment, because I know there's not a lot of time. Doesn't it seem counterproductive to either enable or force a district court to stay with an interpretation of a state court ruling that a state court asserts is incorrect?
Well, I think, Your Honor, we have 2 points there. First of all, if we're right about Rooker-Feldman, the scope of that ruling is irrelevant for two reasons. One, Rooker-Feldman can't apply to a subsequent state court ruling after the federal complaint is filed. And second, as I said, the California ruling was not a ruling on the merits of arbitrability. Zurich did not, and this is a point, Zurich asked Judge Bucklow to rule on arbitration, on the merits, not the California court. It asked the California court under a particular California statute to stay its hand pending Judge Bucklow's determination of the merits, not for the California court to determine the merits of what is arbitrable and what isn't. So we think that ruling is irrelevant in any event, but even were it, Your Honor, I think Judge Bucklow was correct in giving it the narrowest possible construction, given that it's being used to divest her jurisdiction over an FAA petition. And I think the Supreme Court has been very clear that a federal court should not surrender jurisdiction under an abstention doctrine or any other doctrine over a federal arbitration petition unless it's forced to. And here she gave that ruling the narrowest construction possible. And then when she entered her injunction, I think she was right to say that Watts couldn't go back and essentially get the judge to take another bite at the apple. At that point, he was enjoined.
Let me ask you something, because earlier, when you were talking about that September 6th letter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose for a moment that the letter from Watts did not constitute a refusal to arbitrate, okay? Would the federal court still have had jurisdiction to determine arbitrability of the claims when Zurich filed its motion to compel arbitration on October the 4th?
I think it would have, Your Honor. I think because there's both, as Your Honor has noted, the September 6th letter has both a substantive and a procedural component, and both of them are repudiations of the deductible agreement in Zurich's view. The substantive component, and the letter is quite clear, the letter says no deductibles. The deductibles do not apply because you have breached your duty to defend under the insurance contract. And that created a dispute as to whether we had a duty to defend, whether it was breached, and what its effect was on the deductible agreement. The second point in Watts' letter is they say the California court will determine these issues, and they discuss California law, which is a clear denial of the arbitration forum. They're going to present these issues to Judge Lichtman in California. And at that point, Zurich is confronted with a repudiation of the deductible agreement and goes to federal court to seek its right to arbitration. And I think that is exactly proper. There was certainly a ripe controversy at that point about whether they had repudiated the deductible agreement. Zurich, and it's important to note the way this insurance scheme is set up. It is an integrated scheme. Jones and Watts received coverage from Zurich in exchange for these deductible agreements where they essentially self-insured for a substantial portion of both defense costs and indemnification costs, which lowered their premiums. It is a package. It's a comprehensive package. And in that sense, what they're trying to do is get something for nothing. What they're trying to do is get, in California, full defense coverage and no deductibles. And that just rips the parties' agreements apart. And the arbitration clause is there to say if there's any dispute about the enforcement of these deductible agreements, it goes to arbitration. And here they raise the dispute saying these don't apply because you breached the coverage portion. And I think that all goes to arbitration. And I think Judge Bucklow was correct in her ruling that under the FAA, that is exactly right. Where she erred is in applying Rooker-Feldman in a case where it doesn't apply. And I think there I would point out that this complaint, filed on October 4, 2001, pleads an out-of-court injury that has nothing to do with the conduct of the California action. It says, we petitioned to arbitrate, we asked them to arbitrate, and they refused. And that is the injury to Zurich. It's not an injury for anything Judge Lichtman did. It's an injury from Watson Jones refusing to arbitrate. That's what you have to plead in a Section 4 under the FAA. And as the Supreme Court has said, a petition to arbitrate in federal court is not right until you have the refusal to arbitrate. So Zurich didn't sit on its rights here. On the 6th of September, we received a letter that said the deductible agreements are out. You have no right to deductibles. You must give us what's called first dollar coverage. In other words, you pay and you have no recourse. Well, at that point, obviously, Zurich said, we have these deductible agreements. They've been applied in the past, and they resulted in lower premiums. We have to go to arbitration under the arbitration clauses to enforce them. And I think that was entirely proper, and it was in no sense a forum shopping. Watts raised the issue in its letter and said, these agreements are unenforceable. And that is essentially trying to get something for nothing and evade the deductible agreements.
I want to ask you something in the damages area, because you mentioned the damages. Do you have any authority that supports your view you might be entitled to damages from an improperly denied injunction?
Well, I think we made an analogy to some of the cases that say that a granted injunction, if there are damages, then and I don't have a case that's right on point, Judge Williams, on that, no. And I also would allude to the bond cases that, you know, that if there's a dispute over a bond, it might keep the appeal alive. Here, there's absolutely no doubt, as counsel mentioned, that the appeal is alive until the 59E motion is determined. And I would point out to the court that the Rooker-Feldman issue, I think, is the one that is a pure issue of law, that Judge Bucklow has not changed her view from the first PRO all the way to this final ruling. And we believe that ruling's wrong, and I think that the guidance from this court on the Rooker-Feldman issue is critical. And I do think it is, within the meaning of Article 3, case or controversy, it's a live issue, because during that time period, Zurich was forced on pain of contempt against its CEO to pay $9.5 million in defense costs.
Can you explain to me how the district court could have thought that the state court had left unresolved the issue of the duty to defend in the underlying Rothschild action?
I think the district court did two things with the order. It read the word is as a singular. And secondly, it said, I'm essentially going to read this as if Judge Lichtman decided only the issue he needed to in terms of arbitrability in order to render a judgment on what he did render, which was duty to defend in Armenta. I think that was the judge's reasoning. Now, Judge Lichtman has said later, that was not my intent, and it is true that Zurich's motion sought to stay the entire proceeding. But I think the district court gave a fair reading to the order as it stood. It may have misunderstood Judge Lichtman's intent, but I think at that point, as this court's subsequent orders indicate, once her order was entered, Judge Lichtman did not have authority to reinterpret that order or say, you missed my intent. She read the court's order. But I would point out, Your Honor,
he, under all of the analogous cases, he had every right in the world to issue that clarifying order. And if I don't know that you have or haven't, but take a look at Rice versus Sunrise Express at 209 F3rd 1008. It's a 2000 Seventh Circuit case. It's analogous because it involves the federal district and appellate courts haggling, but in assessing whether a particular clarification order was proper, the appellate court said that a district court is well aware that it cannot rewrite history, but can only clarify what had taken place in earlier proceedings, and was simply memorializing the past, not changing the status of the party. So you might want to take a look at that case.
I certainly shall, Your Honor. And as I said, Zurich's primary argument is that the scope of this order is irrelevant.
I understand
for two
that,
reasons. And I guess I would...
If we don't agree with you, then we
have
to...
Yes, well, and I think that there are two, from my point of view, Your Honor, if you would, there are two legal walls there. One is the Rooker-Feldman point, and the second is that this was not a ruling on the merits as to arbitration. And I think that's a key point. If the court looks at the California statutes, there are two separate provisions. One says you can go into a California court and say, please stay this action pending another court ruling on an undetermined petition to arbitrate, which was the case here. There's another statute that would allow you to present the substantive issue of arbitrability to the California court. And as I pointed out, counsel for Watts, when Zurich tried to appeal Judge Lichtman's ruling on the stay on arbitrability, came in and said, oh, no, this is a procedural ruling. You can't appeal a stay. It's not a substantive ruling. And now they sell Judge Bucklow on the argument that, in fact, that Judge Lichtman passed on the substance of arbitration and properly did so.
But let me ask you a bottom-line question, and it is this. if we disagree with you on your interpretation of Rooker-Feldman, are you still, as you stand here today, urging us to stick to an interpretation of a state court ruling that both the parties and the state court know is incorrect?
No, Your Honor, I'm not urging you to do that. If I think there's a difference between the supplemental, you know, I think Judge Bucklow used her interpretive tools, and she said it's like statutory construction, to come up with her construction. I think it's a plausible one, and I think if you stirred in perhaps a presumption in favor of federal arbitration rights, you might get to her result. I think it is clear that Judge Lichterman had a different intent, and as I said, Zurich did move to stay the entire matter. So I'm going to rest on the first two legal walls that I put out. And I would point out that I would really point the court to Gash Associates and Centers, Inc., two Rooker-Feldman cases out of this court. And I think, you know, the analysis is but for causation. Was the harm that the plaintiff is seeking to remedy in federal court caused by the state court action? And here that's clearly not the case. The harm was caused by the refusal to arbitrate. Not by anything Judge Lichtman did. Judge Lichtman didn't do anything until months after that. And one final point, if I might, Your Honor.
Sure, absolutely.
The interpretation that Watts and Jones argue for would mean that a federal court would never be secure in its jurisdiction, because if the state action was filed first, a subsequent state ruling at any time would have Rooker-Feldman effect, even were the case in this court, or even in the Supreme Court on certiorari. If a state court issued a ruling, you'd have to say, oh, well, that was first filed, and therefore Rooker-Feldman divests the court. It's like a Pac-Man that eats federal jurisdiction. And I just don't think that can be. I don't think that's the way the Supreme Court has described Rooker-Feldman. And I think the jurisdictional doctrine has to be applied on the day the complaint is filed. And here, there was no Rooker-Feldman problem the day that complaint was filed. Thank you very much,
Mr. McBride. And Mr. Stansler, you have 3 minutes.
Mr. McCush.
Sorry.
Quite all right.
3 minutes.
I just want to talk a little bit about address some of the questions that the court addressed Mr. McBride. First, the race to the courthouse. The petition itself was a race. It was filed after we filed the summary judgment motion. That was long awaited by the parties. They knew that shoe was going to drop. They had already participated in settlement conferences. They knew what the trial court's analysis of the issue was. That's when they decided to forum shop. But moreover, they ran to federal court. Nothing happened in federal court for another 8 months. And they ran to federal court after the California court threatened to enforce an order directing them to provide a defense that had been in existence for 6 months, and he threatened them with contempt, finally. It's then they went to federal court. That is a race to the courthouse. And it shows, I think, more dramatically than anything else could, that in fact the injury of which they're complaining is in fact the decisions that Judge Lichtman made out in California. The construction of the order, Judge Lichtman's clarification, in our opinion, was not a violation of the preliminary injunction. And even Judge Bucklow had found his prior order ambiguous at most. And she said that if interpreted as Judge Lichtman ultimately indicated that he intended, she would not have any jurisdiction to issue an injunction. And so the California court issued the clarification to clarify that perceived ambiguity, and that was summarily rejected. That was error. That does not show the kind of respect and deference that's appropriate in our system, federalism. There's nothing more destructive than that. I think most of the other points have been addressed in our brief, and I see the red light's on.
You still have a minute if you've got, or
okay.
45
well, that's fine. A word about that September communication. It's been our position all along that that was just a pretext. That was a settlement letter. We were directed by the California court to respond to their only settlement defense. It was sent, and the California court has in fact found in its August 16th ruling that that was a settlement communication, and they tried to turn that into an excuse to invoke federal jurisdiction. Let me touch briefly on the mootness point, because I think Judge Williams indicated, suggested implicit in her question, that there isn't any decision that indicates that an improper denial of an injunction gives rise to an injury here, and that's our analysis as well, Your Honor. But moreover, in the final decision issued by Judge Bucklow earlier this month, again, let me remind the court, she did not refer any policy-related questions to arbitration. So it would be totally speculative on the part of Zurich to suggest that she would now have actually referred policy issues to arbitration had she been able to, had she thought that she was free to issue an injunction back in the spring. Totally speculative. In the end, she has not referred any insurance policy issues to arbitration. So I think that does kind of clinch the mootness point. Any questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. The case will be taken under advisement.